We are in a sermon series called Holy Ground. And what we're doing is visiting different significant places in Scripture, seeing what happened there, not from like a geographical standpoint, but theological. What has God been doing in these different places? And what significance does that hold for us? So several weeks ago, we started in Bethel, the house of God, and we saw Jacob's encounter with God in this random place. And we discovered that holy ground can be anywhere. It doesn't have to be special places, that God can show up anywhere. And then we visited Mount Sinai, or Mount Horeb, as it's known in other places. And we saw that God spoke to Moses with smoke and fire and thunder. And then he shows up in the same place centuries later for Elijah, just with a whisper. And some of us experience God talking to us with the fire and thunder, and sometimes we experience just the whisper. And both are valid ways to encounter God. Then we were on the western side of the Jordan River at Gilgal, where Joshua had people set up stones to commemorate God's provision for them, God's care as he took them out of Egypt and into this new land. And we talked about the importance of memory and markers and telling other generations about what God has done. And last week we were in Shechem, the place of decision, where Joshua calls the people to a choice. And he says, God's done all this for you, and you decide today whom you're going to serve. You can serve one of these other gods, and you're welcome to do that. It's not going to work out well for you. As for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. And we talked about those moments when there's a decision in front of us and what it means to follow God when we make those decisions. Today, we find ourselves in the town of Bethany. Now, Bethany is just a couple of miles east of Jerusalem. Not a super important town. You could walk there from Jerusalem in an hour or two, kind of a suburb, if you will, on the slope of the Mount of Olives. Not a big, important place, not a seat of government, not important buildings there, not big-time decisions that happen in Bethany. But it was significant in the life of Jesus. For instance, he spent most of the last week of his life in or near Bethany. He'd been there before, earlier in his ministry, to teach and to serve. Bethany wasn't important, and it's not important for us because of these significant, earth-shattering things that happened there. Bethany is significant because of what Jesus did there. It's significant today because of what Jesus didn't do there. And that's where we pick up our story. There was a man named Lazarus, and he was sick. Not the kind of sick where you've just got a few coughs. It's the kind of sick where people start talking more quietly when they're in the room with you. It's the kind of sick where people start coming in and gathering. It's the kind of sick that everyone in town would hear about. And so Lazarus has his family and friends gathered there, and well, they don't know what to do, but they know one thing. They send out a request. Really, not even a request, just a statement. The statement is this: Teacher, the one you love is sick. And they tell this to Jesus because Jesus would know what to do. There's not a lot of instructions. Not even a single request, just Lord, the one you love is sick. Jesus would know what to do because he knew Lazarus and he knew his family. He knew Mary and Martha. He'd been there before to teach and to stay. He'd been in this home. He'd been around their kitchen table. Jesus would know what to do. Surely Jesus would move heaven and earth to get there as quickly as he could for the one he loved. And so they send out the statement and they sit back with Lazarus. And he doesn't come. And Lazarus gets more and more sick. And they wait and they wait. And Lazarus dies. And Jesus hadn't come. So his family begins the burial preparations. They prepare the body. They prepare the tomb. They begin their time of mourning. And then a few days later, they get word Jesus is at the edge of the village, and he's coming to them. And then things change. Martha gets up quickly. She goes to meet him. She's all action. So she meets Jesus at the edge of the village, and they talk. And then Martha comes back to her sister Mary, who hadn't gone the first time. Mary didn't get up. Maybe she couldn't. But now Martha comes back, and she says, "The teacher is here, and he's asking for you." And everything changes. Mary stands up quickly, and when she does, all the other mourners follow her. They think she's headed to the tomb to weep, but she's not. She's heading toward Jesus. And when she saw him, John tells us this: she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." That's not small talk. That's not theology. It's not even a request. It's just grief, raw grief shaped into one sentence. And there may have been times where you have spoken a sentence like that too. If only God had. If God had just. That's what Mary is saying. It's not because she doesn't believe in Jesus. It's because she does, and she's disappointed. She wonders why someone who loves them this much did not come sooner. She says it from the ground, at his feet. She's been at his feet before learning. She'll be at his feet a chapter later to anoint his feet. But right now, there's no perfume. It's just grief and a bunch of tears in the dust. And when Jesus sees her there and he sees everybody else weeping, it moves him deeply. He's not composed. He's not serene. John tells us that he was deeply moved in his spirit and troubled. Something in his chest just twists. And then we get the most human and maybe the most memorized verse in all of Scripture. Jesus wept. It's not because he didn't know what was coming next. He did. But because right now, in this moment, he has friends and they're in pain. And that matters to him. And when he weeps, the crowd has two different reactions. Some people see Jesus and they see the validation of who Lazarus was because Jesus is grieving, and they say, "See how he loved him." Then there are others who maybe are a little bit more honest. And they say, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" In other words, if he can do miracles, why didn't he just do one here? It's Mary's question again, it's just in a different voice. If only you'd been here. I think that's a fair question, don't you? Pretty fair concern for someone to voice. Where was Jesus? Why did he take his time? He didn't even have to be there to do something. There's another story in another gospel where a Roman leader sees Jesus, and the leader says, "I've got a servant who's sick, and Jesus, you don't even have to come to my house. You could just say the word right here, and he'd be healed." Jesus does in that moment. One sentence, one moment, a healing from a distance. So then what about Lazarus? What about Mary and Martha? Why not a word for them? Why not a miracle from afar for a good friend? He could have spoken, but he didn't. And if you've ever been in that space between what God could have done and what he did, then you know that ache. You know that he could have intervened, that he could have changed the ending. And sometimes we want to just say, "You were a word away." It's common to hear people say things like, "You know, I'm fine with God. It's the church and Christians I have some questions about." You've heard that. I get it. They love the idea of a loving God, but then they see all of us with our flaws and the ways we don't represent God well. And they're not sure what to do about that. They're fine with God. They're just not sure about the church. I get it. But when tragedy and disaster strikes, if I can just be candid with you for a moment, I kind of feel the opposite. I'm great with the church. It's God I have some questions about. Because I know what the church is going to do when tragedy strikes. They're going to show up with meal trains and casseroles. They're going to send cards by the dozen. They're going to call and say, "What can we do to help?" They're going to load up trucks with supplies and send them. I know what the church does. I've been there. You have too. About 12 years ago, I was sitting in my office when tornadoes were ripping through Oklahoma City and its suburbs. I remember the pit I had in my stomach when I saw the path of a tornado going through the town of Moore, movie theaters and elementary schools and populated areas in its path. And then the next day, I watched people start showing up. What can we do? And we took classrooms and filled them with supplies, and those classrooms had to change into fellowship halls that were full of things, supplies. We had people coming in from all over the country. We had this one van full of grizzled old dudes from Kentucky, long beards, and they come up to me and they're like, "We got a bunch of chainsaws, send us somewhere." Okay. They were ready. I know what the church does when tragedy strikes. Last week, Bo Raley, one of our very own, is heading down to Central Texas and says, "I want to take some supplies." And so you showed up and you brought stuff and filled our covered drive, filled his truck, uncomfortably full, I heard, and you sent things down to people who needed relief. In our own way, we showed up to help. I know what the church does when disaster strikes, and I'm thankful for that. But what about God, who let these things happen? Look, I get that caused and allowed aren't the same thing. I don't think God causes all these bad things to happen. But I'm kind of like Mary. I believe he could have prevented them. And I think cause versus allow is sometimes a theological distinction that doesn't really help on the ground. And when these things happen, there are people who rush in with quick answers. I call that theology with a nice little bow on it. You've heard the answers people will say during these times. They're well-meaning, and I've said them before, and I probably will say them again, unfortunately. God has a plan. Heaven needed another angel. At least they're in a better place. They do that, or maybe they grab their pipe and pull out some John Calvin and opine on God's sovereignty with some verses from Romans. And I'm not saying there's not truth there, but mistimed truth is just more pain. I really appreciate how Troy acknowledged that in his communion talk, that there's not easy answers during these moments. When we do these things, when we say God has a plan, or we just pull out some verse from Romans, that is theology with a little bow on it. But there are some losses that aren't going to hold a bow because the box is too crushed and the wound is too deep. Now, many of us know how today's Bible story ends. Jesus is going to walk to that tomb. He's going to call Lazarus out. And that part of the story is good and it's true, but it's not today's part. Because sometimes when you're in the middle of grief, jumping to resurrection feels like skipping over reality. And today we're still in Bethany. And that's the part of the story where Jesus shows up late, where people are angry, where Mary is weeping in the dirt, and where no miracle has happened, only tears. That's the sacred ground that we're standing on today. And it's enough to know that even there, Jesus is with us. So it may be that you're here today and your version of "if only you'd been here" sounds different. If only we'd caught it earlier. If only I'd told her how I really feel before it was too late. If only this person would have told me the truth. If only I had paid more attention. If only the rain had been lighter. If only the waters had been lower. If only they'd been able to get out of those cabins earlier. If only God had said something or done something or changed something. That ache is real and it is welcome here, because that's what Bethany was. It's a place where pain got voiced and not silenced. And it's a place where people fell apart at Jesus' feet. Because there are some people in our community whom we're grieving who won't be coming back. There's no one walking out of that tomb today. And it's okay to feel the gap between the resurrection story we read about and how we feel today. It's okay to say, I believe in the resurrection, but not quite yet, not today. In Bethany, Jesus didn't skip that grief. He wept with them. And we don't have to skip our grief either. And I think maybe that's what holy ground really looks like. Not a miracle, not always a healing, but a place where grief is real, a place where God is near, a place where Jesus doesn't offer answers, just presence, and a place where God weeps too. And so maybe we don't always get to tie a bow on our theology, and all we can do is tie a bow on a tree. We don't tie a bow because we have all the answers or because it fixes everything. We tie it because we want to remember. We tie it because we say, we are here. Those people were here. God was here too, somehow. And we don't have all the answers for that, but our grief is real. We tie those bows because we care, not because we understand everything. We tie those bows because we are still hoping that God will show up even if it's late. Jesus showed up and he wept. And sometimes that's the most holy thing that God can do, and it's the most holy thing that we can do. Bethany was holy ground because God wept there. And this can be too. May God bring us comfort and hope in these difficult times, trusting that the ground we stand on is holy ground because God meets us in our grief. Let's stand and sing.